You must be very proud. Yes, yes. Okay, so he's a very naughty boy. Yes, that's true too. Okay, we have been going through the Bible, and today we're looking at the book of, let's see, that says Job under there, but it's not, it's Esther. And it's page 396 in your blue Bibles that are in the pews in front of you, in case you don't have yours with you. It's 396, it's the book of Esther. And the title is For Such a Time as This. Now, there aren't notes. If you're a guest today, you might see others looking around wondering, like they lost something, because we normally have notes every Sunday in our program, and they normally get printed on Friday. And Friday, my mom arrived. I spent the whole day, I didn't even come to the office, spent the whole day cleaning, because mom was coming, and the house had to be clean, right? So isn't it funny, when moms are waiting for their baby to come home, they clean everything, everything's ready, right? They call it nesting, getting everything at home ready for the baby. And now when mom comes home, we do the same thing. We're getting everything ready. Oh, mom's coming. It's got to look good. It's got to look clean. But I do have some slides that we'll be going through, and we have, we've also been putting a Spanish translation, not just today, actually the last 3 weeks, because we have some Spanish speakers that have been attending and want them to be able to follow along. So I may just even try to summarize at different moments what I've been saying in English so that they can stay with us. So last week we looked at the book of Job, and today Esther, we're going through the Bible this year. And the book of Esther, or let's see, last week we looked at Job and we asked the big question about suffering and why good people suffer, and is God just? Because it seems sometimes like the unrighteous and wicked people are blessed and the righteous people or God-fearing people suffer. And that was the big question last week. And it starts off with Satan accusing not only Job, but God. And I bring it up because in the book of Esther, you know, it's so, this series has been so cool, because when we think about Esther, we think about the moment in her life in chapter 4 where she had to make a decision, and how, you know, she became a nobody to the queen of Persia. But after having read Job last week and reading Esther this week, I see that there's some similar themes going through it. Like last week we saw that even in the book of Job that talks about suffering, there's this theme about the Redeemer, the mediator, the one who will stand before us, not to accuse us, but to advocate for us, speak on our behalf before God. Well, in this book, we see a similar theme about how God works when we see an accuser. So there's some major characters we're going to look at here. First is Xerxes in chapter 1. So we're going to, King Xerxes, the king of Persia, Esther, her cousin Mordecai, and a man named Haman. That's who we're going to be looking at today. So in chapter 1, we're introduced to King Xerxes, the Persian king. So let's start there. Chapter 1, verse 1. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. At the time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all the nobles and officials, the military leaders of Persia and Media, and princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor, his glory, his majesty. And it goes on talking about the citadel, the palace, the gardens, and how they were drinking wine out of golden goblets and cups. Each one was decorated differently. And in verse 8, by the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink with no restrictions. For the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. So they've had 180 days where he's been with the nobles, leaders, the military leaders, and now they're having one big week of partying. And the king was known for partying hard and drinking a lot. And in a moment, we'll talk about how he was in good spirits because of how much he had been drinking. And the reason he's doing this is because he's getting ready. He's been a king for just a few years. He's getting ready to march against Greece. How many of you guys have seen the movie 300, where this is Xerxes and his men has come against the Spartans and the Greeks, and Leonidas stands against him, right, with his 300 men. That's all based on a historical fight that occurred. It's called the Battle of Thermopylae, and it was this King Xerxes that went against Greece, and he's getting ready to go. So they've been 180 days getting everything ready, preparing, planning, getting money from his nobles to be able to finance this war. That's all what's happening during these few chapters. And as they march, right, just so you get an idea of what this guy's like, as they march to Greece, right around the border of Turkey that would go into Greece or Mesopotamia, there's a water between two of the seas, the Caspian Sea, I think, and the Aegean Sea, and it's called, at that time, it was called Hell's Port. And Xerxes built a bridge, a pontoon bridge, over this sea or this water that at its most narrow place was 3/4 of a mile long, and its widest maybe 3.5. So that's how wide this was. So think about the English Channel, but smaller, right? Or maybe even like our Great Lakes, that at one point is only about 3/4 of a mile long. He built a pontoon bridge across it so his soldiers could get across on their invasion of Greece. But right after they built it, or not long after, a storm destroyed the bridge. And he was so upset that he ordered that the sea be whipped 30 times and threw chains, shackles into the sea, symbolically trying to shackle the sea. And then he beheaded all the men who built the bridge after it was destroyed. Someone who donated what today would be about $10 million towards his military campaign asked if his oldest son could not go to war because he wanted at least one son to stay back with him. He killed his son and had the soldiers march by his body on their way out. That's this Xerxes, right? So you read Esther and it kind of seems like a love story, but this man is not a man to be played with, right? And in verse 9, he is married to a queen. He has a queen named Vashti. Now, she was having, it says in verse 9, a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. So king's having his party, she's having hers. On the seventh day, the King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine. He commanded the 7 eunuchs who served him. So he commands these men to go get the queen and bring her wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. This is not a guy you want to tick off, right? We already know that. So why would the queen say no? It doesn't give us all the details here, but again, many believe, number one, he was drunk. He's already said, everybody just drink as much as you want. So this is a room of drunken men, and she's the queen. And some believe that whatever it was that he wanted her to do would have been degrading, not just because of her position, but so she says no. She defies the king, and he is angry. So then he goes to his advisors, okay, what do I do? And starting in verse 16, Memucan, one of his advisors, says, listen, this is a problem. She hasn't only defied you, but this is a problem for all of the nobles in the provinces. Look at verse 17. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women so that they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she did not come or would not come. This very day, Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end to the disrespect and discord. In other words, when my wife hears that your wife didn't listen to you, and she's going to say, she doesn't need to listen to me. And the way they're talking about it is almost like this is going to bring down the Persian Empire. Like if women speak their mind or women have an opinion or women are respected, it's going to bring down the whole world. So therefore, it says, the king says, all right, well, what do I do? And they said, you got to make a law, make an edict. And verse 19, he says that. So that she will be stripped from her royal position, taken away from the king's presence, not killed, but removed from the king's presence, never to be able to be before him again, removed of her title, and then someone else be made queen. So they did it. They sent that out. And then in chapter 2, we're introduced to Esther. So there's Esther is an orphan. Doesn't tell us how, but her mom and dad have died, and she's living with her cousin Mordecai. Mordecai and Esther are Jews, but they're keeping it a secret. They're not letting people know that they're Jews. So the king goes off and fights Greece. And between chapter 1 and 2, a few years goes by, and so it's believed that he went and fought the Greeks, then came back. And then he's like, okay, well, says he kind of missed Vashti. He missed not having his queen, and they started the search. Some have called it like a pageant or a competition, but, you know, in a competition, people sign up. You know, this wasn't, you know, Persian Idol. Who wants to be the queen of Persia? Most likely, they went in, and if your daughter was attractive, they took her, just like that. So they went through the city of Susa and the province there, and they got who were they believed were the most beautiful young ladies, virgins, and they brought them into the palace. And for a whole year, they got beauty treatments. I mean, it was probably seeming pretty sweet for a little while, right? I mean, it's pretty awesome. Some of you ladies yesterday had a day that you were pampered, right? You had a nice little makeover yesterday. Well, Esther and these other ladies go through this for an entire year. And then after they've been through this for a year, each of them gets to go before the king for at least one night. And God gives favor with the eunuchs, the men in charge of the harem. The guy in charge, he likes Esther. And he takes care of Esther. He coaches Esther. And when they got time to go before the king, they could take whatever they wanted, any jewelry, anything they wanted to take, they could take. But she was smart. She goes to the head eunuch and says, you tell me what I should take. Anyway, she goes in. We see that in chapter 2. She goes in, meets with the king, and it says the king liked her and loved her more than anyone else. And just so you know, after that night with the king, if the king didn't choose you, you didn't go back home. You stayed in the king's harem. So when you got picked off the street or whatever it was to go and be a part of this, it was goodbye to your family. And if the king wasn't interested in you, then you would just be a part of his harem, unable to marry anyone else, unable to have any children of your own. So that was her situation that she found herself in. The king picks her, and she becomes his wife. So I'm just going to tell the story, and then I'm going to get to a point where I'm going to pull some points out here. At the end of chapter 2, there's something very interesting that's only a few verses, but comes into play later on. Mordecai, it says now, is serving at the king's gate, which is kind of like the court. If you to sit at the king's gate means that you were there, you had some level of place in the king's court. So either he was already there, or Esther used her influence to get that job for Mordecai. Well, Mordecai overhears a plot. It says two of those that served the king became angry with him and plotted to kill the king. It's not hard to imagine what the king might have done to them, but they wanted to kill the king. Mordecai hears it, tells Esther. Esther goes and tells the king. They investigate, and sure enough, they were plotting to kill the king. But nothing was done for Mordecai, right? He saved the king's life, but nothing was done for him, to honor him. Even though Esther made it a point to make sure that he knew who it was. Now in chapter 3, we're introduced to a man named Haman. And just like in Job, that it starts with Satan trying to destroy one of God's servants, and you go all the way back to Genesis in chapter 3, and you have Satan trying to destroy what God has started, here we have Satan working through a man named Haman. So it doesn't tell us where he comes from. He's just honored. The king honors Haman and the Agagite, elevating him and giving him the seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles and princes. All the other officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. So they, royal officials, you know, officials, they say this to Mordecai, why are you doing this? And then look at verse 5. Haman is filled with anger and rage, and he says, when Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet, having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people. I forgot I said I was going to summarize a little bit in Spanish, So, no sé si usted o mami está aquí, pero para que entienda, estamos hablando de Esther en la Biblia y estamos hablando de cómo ella fue elegida de la calle hasta ser la reina en Persia. Y ahora viene otro hombre que es un malvado que quiere matar a todos los judíos en Israel. Okay, just a little summary. Okay, so normally you say something in Spanish, it takes a lot longer, right, than the English translation. But that was very, very brief. Anyway, chapter 3. So this guy, he goes to the king. Again, he's highly honored by the king. And the king is insane anyway. He's a murderer anyway and power hungry. So he goes to the king and he says, King, there's these people in the kingdom. Now, just so you understand, again, remember, we looked at Nehemiah a few weeks ago where the Jews had been taken to Babylon. And King Darius, Xerxes' grandfather, let them go back to Jerusalem, as God had prophesied through the prophets Isaiah and Jeremiah. But only 50,000 went back. It's believed that there could have been up to 500,000 Jews that stayed in Persia and Babylon, right? Their lives were there, their families were there. So Haman tells him, there's these people, these Jews, and they're a problem, and they're rebellious, and they need to be eradicated. We need to get rid of them. So I propose that on this month, I think it's on the 12th day of the month of Adar, that you write a decree allowing, and this is what it says. Look at chapter 3, verse 12. Then on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretary were summoned, and they wrote out the script of each province. And it says in verse 13, dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, on a single day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. And a copy of the edict was issued as law in every province. I mean, listen to the words there. Kill, destroy, annihilate. When we look at how God's whole purpose, right, is to, through the nation of Israel, give his word and his laws so that Jesus could come and there'd be a context for us to recognize the Savior, the Messiah, who would save us. And Satan is wanting to wipe out, destroy, annihilate. And it's not too hard for us to really imagine this or picture it, because it happened again in the 1940s, didn't it? Wasn't that Hitler's goal, genocide, to eradicate the earth of Jews in particular? So Satan's plan is continuing on, but God continues to deliver. So it happens. The law is made. You can't go back. He's allowing on a certain day of the year, one day, you can attack, kill any Jew you want and take their home, their property, their wealth, anything. So chapter 4 is a pivotal chapter. Mordecai hears about it, and he starts to wail. He starts to weep. He puts on sackcloth and ashes in a way of protest. And then Esther hears about it. So she sends for Mordecai to say, hey, what's going on? And they tell Mordecai, and Mordecai explains what it is that has happened. And then in chapter 4, verse 8, he also gave a copy of the text of the edict and of their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show Esther and explain it to her. And he told him to instruct her to go to the king's presence and to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Hathach went back to report this to Esther, as Mordecai had said. Now, Esther's response to Mordecai is, okay, you can't go into the king's presence unless he calls you. So even though they're married, it's not like the president of the United States and the first lady, right? They go to the same bedroom every night. They're a married couple. She had her own quarters, and he had his. And she could only go see him if he asked for her, if he summoned her, called her. He hadn't called her for 30 days or over 30 days. She's like, our law says if I go into his presence unannounced, the law says I am to be executed, to be killed, unless the king extends his scepter to me. So here, she sends that message to Mordecai, her cousin, and this is what Mordecai says, right? He sent back this answer. Do not think that because you are the king's, are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. So she responds and says, okay, pray. Have everyone pray for 3 days. And I'll have my people pray for 3 days as well. And she says, gather everyone in verse 18. Gather everyone to pray. Don't eat or drink for 3 days. When this is done, I will go to the king. Even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. That was her response. So let's look at something we talked about last week, right? Because remember we said last week when trials come, when pressure comes, when the test comes, that's when you see what's on the inside, right? You see when you start to see when pressure is applied, what comes out of us. And that's why I think mothers don't become mothers just when they have children. La madre no se vuelve en madre solamente cuando tengan hijos. And my point is this, because we've, you might say, well, wait a minute, obviously that, haven't you heard or haven't you probably also thought just because a man can have a child doesn't make him a father, right? I mean, not maybe in the biological sense, yes. But at this moment, and I mention this because that those qualities, the qualities that we're going to see in Esther from what she just did and how she responded and what she does, they were already there. It doesn't mention whether she's had any children or not at this point, right? And there are women who may have had 2, 3 children, but the people that look at them as mothers are so many more. Or ladies who have had no biological children. But we see motherhood and protectiveness and care and nurturing all over them. That's why we give a flower or a rose to every woman as they're going. Not just because some may not have had the privilege or the blessing or the opportunity or the ability to have a physical child. But all the qualities of motherhood are still wrapped up inside of you, right? So Esther goes, they pray. And so here's what one of the first things we see in Esther is faith. En la respuesta de Esther, vemos que ella tenía fe. She has faith. And because listen to what he says to you. If you remain silent, if you remain silent, don't think that this is it, that you alone will be saved, right? So, but once she has faith, because the first thing she does is she goes and she prays. She prays and she says, and she fasts 3 days. So she takes it to God. She doesn't just go on her own and say, well, let's see, you know, hope for the best. 3 days fasting, no eating, just praying, asking God, God, when I finally go into his presence, the king's presence, please give me success. So she has faith. Second thing is she shows bravery. Era valiente. Because of what she was about to do. You know, we think about David and Goliath. Remember, David was the young boy. He becomes a king, but when he was just a young boy, he fought the giant Goliath, and he killed Goliath. And normally, when we think about Goliath, the first thing we think of is how he represents our challenges, the giants in our lives that we need to tackle. I heard a pastor recently talk about how Goliath, not just that he was a challenge to overcome, but Goliath made David. If it wasn't for the giant, David is still a shepherd boy. Now, David had the faith already in him. He believed God. He had that bravery in him, but if it wasn't for the chance to show it. So the challenges, the Goliath, the challenges of parenting, of life, those make us. It's when we have a chance to step up. It's when we have a chance to see exactly who we are and who God has made us to be. And I think about Esther, and I think about another person in the Bible named Joseph. Joseph was in the book of Genesis. Joseph was beaten almost to the point of death by his own brothers. Then they sold him into slavery, and the people that bought him took him all the way down to Egypt. When he was in Egypt, he was serving as a servant, and then he was falsely accused of a crime and thrown into the king's dungeon. And you got to imagine, right, that there are moments when Joseph is probably thinking, you know, God, I don't know, why am I here? Right? Well, why did you put me here? What's going on? How are you ever going to get me from where I am to where you said I was supposed to be, or where you were going to place me? And I think of Esther, because see, Joseph, the story is that God raised him from the dungeon. He raised him to the right hand of Pharaoh in Egypt. When the drought came, it was Joseph that saved not only his own people, but even the Egyptians. Well, now you have a woman raised, right, to a high position in the Persian Empire. But she's probably not thinking like Joseph, God, why am I here? Why is this? She's probably thinking, thank you, God, man. I'm the queen. I get beauty treatments. My life is set. This is awesome. Thank you, God. She was probably going from day to day, not really even realizing that God had something bigger for her. Maybe she did, maybe she didn't. But then the time came. And that's where Mordecai says, you know, don't think if you stay silent. And here's the thing. We may not, most likely, right, chances are, none of us are going to become kings or queens, marry a queen or a king, be ruler. So don't look at Esther and say, well, that's Esther. That was, you know, that hardly ever happens to anybody. Look at the principle. She had an opportunity to stay quiet or to speak up. I've seen videos of social experiments where they put a camera across the street of like a bus stop bench or a park bench, that somebody comes along and sits down. And then someone else with a child will come and sit down. And as they sit down, pretending to wait for the bus, the adult starts insulting the child, like being rude to the child, saying really mean, nasty things. And they do it to see how long it will take the random person to speak up, to say something, to defend or stand up. And just, you know, so we may not have, you know, here's one of the things I think of. We may not have the chance, right? You may not save a nation. Your voice may not save a nation, but it can still save. Tal vez no como Esther vamos a poder salvar una nación entera, pero podemos salvar por lo menos una persona. We can save. We can still save. We can still encourage. We can still uplift. We can still talk somebody off of the edge. We can still talk someone into believing that they can do what God has called them to do. So she has faith, she's brave, and there's sacrifice. And, right, she says, well, if I'll go and if I perish, I perish. She very likely, she didn't know what was going to happen. And she was willing to sacrifice. Again, we don't know if she had any children of her own, very likely, but at this point doesn't even mention her own children, but definitely she saved tens of thousands of children with her actions. So she goes in before the king, and the king extends the scepter to her. He saves her. She's able to live and speak to the king. But at this moment, again, she shows sacrifice, which to me is one of the hallmarks, right, of mothers. Sacrifice and giving of themselves, and she's willing to do that. Then, so she goes before the king, and the king says, okay, well, he sees her, he extends the scepter, she comes, approaches him, and he says, well, what do you want? Anything, ask me anything, up to half of the kingdom. And she says, She didn't want to say it in front of the whole crowd, so she says, well, if it's okay, I want to invite you to a banquet. But you and Haman, I want you to bring Haman. So she wants him to bring the guy who wants to annihilate her people. Again, the king doesn't know she's a Jew, and Haman doesn't know she's a Jew. Haman is beside himself. He is so excited. He's like, you know, he's feeling really good. His chest is, you know, sticking out. He's like, she invited only me, the king, and me. Like, wow, this is awesome. So they go to the banquet, and the king says, okay, tell me, what did you want to ask? For some reason, again, this is God working, but for some reason, she doesn't tell him that night. Instead, she says, well, if it's okay, let me have another dinner for you tomorrow. I'll have another banquet, another meal. Come tomorrow night, you and Haman again, and then I'll tell you. Again, she can't know what's happening, but for some reason, she delays it one more night. Again, this is God at work. Here's what happens next. Haman, it says in chapter 6, right, that happens in chapter 5. At the end of chapter 5, it says Haman's rage against Mordecai. He leaves the banquet. He's on his way home, and there's Mordecai, and Mordecai, again, refuses to bow down to him. And he goes home, and he tells his wife, and he tells his friends, right, in chapter 5, he's telling them what an honor it was that I was able to go and eat with the king and the queen, right, verse 12. And that's not all. Haman added, I am the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king. And she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. So then his wife and his friends come up with an idea. You need to get this pole, like make sometimes it says it was like a gallows to hang him on or a pole to stick him on. But it was 75 feet high. Like make it 75 feet high and just get rid of this guy. Just kill him, hang him, or impale him on this pole. And he's like, okay, and he orders it, and they start putting this pole into the ground. Well, the next day, or that night, chapter 6, that night, the king can't sleep. And this is God working. It wouldn't have worked the night before if she had said anything. So now the king's he can't sleep, so he calls and he says, bring me the chronicles of the record of his reign. So in other words, he wants to read, like, court reports and chronicles, maybe to help him go to sleep. And then as he's reading, this is how God works. The scroll they bring to him is the one that tells about how Mordecai saved his life. And then he thinks, oh, yeah, that guy, Mordecai, that saved my life. And he asked the people that were reading it to him, did anything ever get done to reward Mordecai? And they're like, no, king, nothing was done to reward Mordecai. Oh, well, we gotta do something. We gotta honor this guy. He saved my life. That morning, Haman walks in. And it says in chapter 6, it says in verse 6, now when Haman entered, the king asked him, what should be done to the man the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought to himself, who is there that the king would rather honor than me? Right? Again, he's so full of himself. And he's like, oh, the king wants to honor me. And he says, okay, well, king, here's what you do. You take a robe, one of your royal robes that you've worn in public, everybody has seen you wear, and you give it to this man. Then you take one of your horses that you've ridden in public or rode in public and put your crest on its head, and then have one of your most highest and noble princes of Persia escort this man on your horse wearing your robe through the streets of Susa, declaring, so it is done to the man in whom the king delights to honor. So it will be, and so it is done to the man in whom the king delights to honor. And then look at verse 10. Go at once, the king commanded Haman. Get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai, the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. He says, don't neglect anything that you said. So now he is humiliated. He's walking through the streets having to say, so it is done for the man in whom the king delights to honor. And there's Mordecai on the horse. Well, he goes home. And at the end of the chapter, his wife says, you know what? Look at verse 13. He tells his wife, his advisors and his wife said to him, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. you will surely come to ruin. Well, why does she say that? When God told Abraham in Genesis, I'm going to make you into a great nation. Those who bless you, I will bless. Those who curse you or who stand against you, I will stand against. So she's basically declaring that promise, that covenant, saying that's it. He's Jewish, and to stand against him is basically in this context, or his people, is to stand against God. Well, chapter 7, Haman, it says right at that moment, the officials came to take him back to the banquet. They're at the banquet, and finally the king asks her again, what is it, Esther, you want me to do for you? Whatever it is, up to half the kingdom. And she says, to save me and my people. Right in verse 3, the queen Esther answered, if I have found favor in you, with you, your majesty, and it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition, and spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold or destroyed or killed and annihilated. So then he says, who is this that has done this? In verse 6, Esther answered, an adversary, an enemy, this vile Haman. And Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Long story short, one of the servants comes up and says, King, Haman just built this 75-foot pole to kill Mordecai. And the king says, hang him on it. The very pole that he erected to kill Mordecai, Haman meets his end. Well, you still got a problem. There's still a date where the king has authorized all the Jews in the land to be killed and all their property taken. And he can't take it back. Right? The law of the Persians could not be reversed, even by the king. So now he goes to Mordecai, whom he has elevated to the position that Haman used to have. And he says, do this. On the same day, authorize the Jews to defend themselves. And if anyone attacks them, they can defend themselves, and they can take and keep whatever they get from those who attack them. And it says that many of the people in Susa, when they saw this, they believed in the God of the Jews. They started to follow him because they saw how much God was with them. So the last thing that we see in Esther compared with Haman is that she is humble. Where Haman's pride, remember the Bible says pride comes before a fall. God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. And I think, you know, as Ruth mentioned earlier, when we come to days like Mother's Day, not all of us can post on Facebook, Happy Mother's Day to the best mom in the world. And not all of us still have our moms. But God provides. There's a reason that the Bible and you know, the Christians call themselves brothers and sisters, and my brother, and you know, this is the first time my mom's been with me for Mother's Day for 4 years, but there are ladies in this church, and it's been the case in every church that I've been in, that love me like a son, not like a pastor, but like a son. And if you're needing that, God will provide that. You need to only look and see. So, will you pray with me as we honor the Lord and those that he's brought into our lives as moms? Father, thank you so much for this afternoon, for this message, for the story of Esther and the qualities that we see in her of courage, bravery, faith, sacrifice, humility. Some of the qualities that make a mom a good mom, a great mom. And thank you for your grace today, because even though we think our parents, our moms are great, I think my dad was awesome, my mom's awesome, but I don't think I'm the greatest dad. So for the moms in here who, if there's any regret, just thinking, yeah, I wish I could have done something better, I wish I'd done this differently, I want you to know there's grace today. There's healing today. there's new life today, like we saw in the baptisms. There could be a new life today, amen, where the qualities and the characteristics of Jesus can be deposited in you. New life, born again. There's grace, there's forgiveness in Jesus. And there's opportunities to continue to be a loving mother to so many more people than just your own children. And to love them, to bless them. Not everyone, but to those that God brings into your life, that gives you that special relationship. We thank you, Father. And ask that you would do that honoring. I hope that our mothers today, Lord, feel honored and feel loved and celebrated and encouraged and hopeful. And that all of us, men or women, would also see in Esther an example of faith to follow.